This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Count 'em two productions at two companies that opened on the same weekend. Good fortune and undoubtedly a nightmare of scheduling for the veteran playwright. We're going to hear about her two world premieres, The Lost Boy at Artist Repertory Theater and A Noble Failure at Third Rail Repertory Theater. Both shows are part of the astounding 10-day Fertile Ground Festival of New Works. So stay with us. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We just heard a song from Northwest singer and harpist Molly Baucom. To hear her original music, visit mollybaucom.com. With me in my office studio is Susan Mock, Oregon Book Award-winning playwright who has the bounty of two professional productions of her two new plays at the very same time, The Lost Boy at Artist Repertory Theater and Noble Failure at Third Rail Repertory Theater. Sue, welcome to Stage and Studio.
Thank you.
You have been the talk of Portland theater right now. I mean, especially the talk of Portland playwrights and theater folks in general. You're a full-time teacher and a mom, and I think the question everybody wants to know is, how the heck did you manage Tech Week and two openings on the same weekend?
Nobody got very much sleep in our house. But Tech Week, the fortunate thing for me was the bulk of rehearsals for both shows fell during Christmas break. So I was able to flit from rehearsal to rehearsal. And then during Tech Week started the first week of school. So Nora, my daughter, went to rehearsals with me. And then a few nights she stayed at a neighbor's house until 11 and was rousted out of bed to go home. So it was just, we just did it. And I'm here, still standing, to tell the tale.
And you look lovely and gorgeous and well-rested after that exciting week. So which one did you end up seeing first?
I saw Noble Failure first. And my daughter went with my niece to Lost Boy. So I like to say that my DNA was represented at both places. It was the best I could do.
Did she give you notes on it?
Yes, she did. And apparently she did the toast in my honor, I hear. So... She stepped in.
Well, so, I bet she was thrilled about that.
She was. She had a really good time hanging out backstage at Lost Boy. She liked that play.
Well, I think for kids, too, even though it is, you know, we'll talk more about what it's about, there were the circus elements. Mm-hmm. You know, I would think that the young people would really be drawn to that.
Yes, she had a lot of fun watching the rehearsal of that. She fell in love with the kids. They were fast friends, so it was, yes, she much preferred hanging out there. Noble Failure, she's like, she didn't quite understand what was going on. So we had a lot of talks about it. I mean, she understands theoretically, but it's not as much fun.
Well, for an 11-year-old, hanging out with the other 11-year-old kids in the cast would probably be a lot more fun anyway.
Yes, most certainly.
Well, both plays had a solid path to production. You had strong readings as part of the Northwest Playwriting Competition for Coho Productions last year, and that was your play, A Noble Failure. So that one got a very strong reading. You know, I was at the stage reading for that. And The Lost Boy was produced as a reading at Portland Center Stage's Jaw West Festival. Mm-hmm. And so by the time you started rehearsal, when did you start rehearsal?
5 weeks before open. So it was right after Thanksgiving, very shortly after Thanksgiving started.
So for both productions?
Yes.
So, I mean, by then you had very solid scripts.
Yes, but I still did a lot of rewriting for both shows. The scripts were in good shape to start rehearsal, yes.
But I can't imagine there were any major changes.
Nothing too major. Noble Failure, we ended the first act differently. That was probably the biggest structural change in that. And then there weren't any huge structural changes for Lost Boy. I kept rewriting the ending. The circus stuff we changed a lot because we had a circus performer. So I wrote some stuff especially for him, for Jeff, because he was so delightful. He brought so much in terms of what he could do as an escape artist. And so I wrote some stuff around that that I don't know would go on with the script because it seemed to fit what he could do. And that was kind of, that was really fun to write, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine that the circus stuff, would you wouldn't be able to really script that until you actually see it and you have the performers to work with. All that physical staging has to be done.
Yeah, that was Alan and the actors. They did, they coordinated all of that. And so it was very fun to watch. and as I said, I just wrote a little bit of dialogue to try to fit what they were doing.
Well, last year at this time, we talked about both these plays as readings. It's almost like we've talked about this before, but it's the good fortune of seeing them actually produced.
Yes,
you know, and that doesn't happen very often.
I am so lucky. It was just this confluence of, I don't know. Maybe I did something nice to somebody in a past life or something. But it was a I feel extremely lucky. I mean, it wasn't easy. I would never like to have two shows opening on this, two world premieres on the same night. I don't want to ever have to kind of go through that again. But I'm still counting my blessings that I got to do this. So,
was there a time when you kind of said to Alan Noss, like, could you do it any later? Or
I think I did mention that once, and the answer was no.
Not to jinx anything,
exactly.
But is it possible to move?
Oh, yeah, and there was no, so there we were.
Well, I think it's definitely deserved. You know, you've worked really hard on both these plays, and it seems like sometimes the staged reading is the last stop for productions, and it's actually, I think, inspiring to a lot of playwrights that it's not the last stop.
Well, thank you. And I think you and I have had this conversation before, the reading train. And for years, I just seemed that I would get so far with the reading, and then that next step just never seemed to happen. And it happened. I was lucky, and this time it happened in a big way. But yes, and I'm hoping that the shows do well enough that theaters will say, you know, this works, this next step. And people are interested in seeing local playwrights and local work. So hopefully this will be the beginning of a trend.
I'm hoping that it is a better time for that to happen, because it seemed like for a while there, the world premiere train was the last stop too. Like, you could have a world premiere, but then it didn't go to another city.
Yeah. That's true, too.
And I think Portland is big enough now where it's impressive, perhaps, or for a while there, it didn't seem like, well, you know, it just happened
Portland.
In Portland, right?
Yes, yes, hopefully. Yeah, especially with Noble Failure, I'm getting a lot of people calling me about Noble Failure. So we'll see if that's going to happen.
I hope that happens. I definitely think, it's timely. Both plays are very timely, but Noble Failure especially.
Yeah, I like to say I wrote, you know, every playwright tries to write for the ages, but I really wrote that one for right now. And if it dates in 5 years, because all this stuff is no longer happening, that's fine with me.
You'll be happy with that. We're going to talk about Noble Failure, but I want to actually start off with The Lost Boy. And because I hadn't seen it as a staged reading, and I was able to look at it as a production rather than making any kind of comparisons, which you often do with staged readings. You go, oh, well, I didn't remember that, or that changed, or, you know, you can't help, especially with cast changes, thinking, oh, well, that other person did it this way. So I was impressed with the mix of circus and media circus elements. And you had the juxtaposition of the circus, but you also had sort of the media circus that surrounds any kind of sensational news topic. And also the juxtaposition of the story of the kidnapped boy and his grieving parents. Mm-hmm. Lost Boy, you know, I think we talked a little bit about the inspiration of the actual story, but would you tell me what inspired you?
Back in when the Ward Weaver kidnappings were happening, was, I think my daughter was roughly two, driving back and forth to work, I would see the big posters when they hadn't figured out who had, you know, kidnapped those. It was Miranda Gaddis and Ashley Pond who had and there were posters and signs, and it was on the news everywhere every day. And when they finally figured out the crime, the house was blocks from where I teach out of Clackamas. And driving to work one day, I saw all the helicopters and the people, you know, just milling about out almost all the way out onto Highway 213. And I stopped and I looked to see what was happening. And it was a fence, and you could see guys with FBI jackets still cleaning out the house. They were still at work. And then you saw this fence with, you know, this things that, you know, stuffed animals and flowers and notes, and then people coming and going. And then across the street was these big vans and satellites and news media people with microphones, and it was crazy. And I thought, how could you as a parent live through this? Your absolute worst fear, your worst nightmare, and then the spectacle that seemed to be happening. And I thought, I wanted to write something, but I didn't want to write about that. And then I heard the Paula Foss was a woman who wrote a book called The History of Child Kidnapping in the United States. I don't even think it was United States. Yes, it was in the United States. And the Charlie Ross story was the first story in the book. And I thought, that's an interesting, the parallels were so evident that I just started doing research on the story and going from there. And so I just searched the internet and found a copy of the father's book and read that, which was fascinating.
Did you end up using excerpts from the book?
Well, all of the letters those were in the book. And so the letters, many of them are very close to what the actual letters were. And the Douglas, the Mosher was the kind of mastermind. And Douglas was, when they found him, he didn't have a home. He was probably developmentally disabled in some ways. All the evidence.
The kidnapper.
So the evidence for that was in the book. And then this Ross, and what was fascinating to me that he kept talking about providence, that I'm a good person. I've done these, they're bad people. Justice will be served to me in the end at some point. And he was sure of that even years later. And this, of course, the sad thing is it never was. They never found. I theorize that the media spectacle really influenced the fate of Charlie Ross.
So this was, just as a background, this was a post-Civil War era. I mean, there was a huge depression after that time period, a lot of poverty, a lot of crime was happening.
Absolutely.
At that time. And so that sets the stage for this kidnapping to take place.
Yes, absolutely. And it was the overselling of the railroads. And so you had middle-class people like Christian Ross, who had bought into the bubble, I guess, is the modern day term for it. And his business was not doing well, and he was not the person that the kidnappers thought he was. Doesn't justify anybody's actions, but certainly and it was a time very similar to what we're experiencing right now.
Well, I actually got a question from a fan of yours on Facebook. I said, I'm going to be interviewing Sue Mock, and got any questions? And I don't know if she wants me to mention her name, but it's Ronnie LaCroix. And she said, she wanted to find out how you balance the circus scenes and the scenes with the grieving parents, and she also wanted to know why you decided to make the kidnappers more sympathetic. And I think it's a little bit about that, the disability as well as the poverty of that time.
Mm-hmm. And also I read, there were, I can't remember, roughly 25 letters that read back to back tell a story. And I developed the characters in Lost Boy through the story of the letters. But I couldn't help feeling somewhat, I got the sense that here was these guys, they were desperate. And I think it really was, they were going to try to do this thing, make some quick money, and move on. And then it just got spiraled out of control.
Well, amidst that sad story, though, I think it's a real societal examination of that time period and the fact that some things don't really change. You have P.T. Barnum in there. And on the one hand, he's helpful,
right.
And he helps the family and raise funds and get the word out. But on the other hand,
it's not without strings. and he really did that. And that was what inspired me to do the whole circus thing, was that he said, at one point he did say that he would, if he did find Charlie, he offered this reward money that he would like to put him and the whole family on exhibit. There was an intemperate family and a temperate family of good, and that this one circus remade the temperate family into the Ross family and fashioned the suffering Rosses. And this was when it was decided that Christian Ross was okay. And Ross had to sort of defend his name, because when they couldn't find Charlie Ross, people were anxious for some kind of story. So then all of a sudden it was, maybe he cooked the whole thing up because he was broke and he needed some money. So that was, and there actually was a Broadway play that implicated him.
The Lost Boy runs through February 10th at Artist Repertory Theater, and it's Tuesdays through Sunday at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. For more info, visit artistrep.org or fertilegroundpdx.org or Stage and Studio. kbooks.org. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. You're listening to Stage and Studio, a special edition with playwright Susan Mock in my studio. Sue, let's talk about your other play, because you do have two productions that we need to talk about, and, you know, they're running in repertory in the Susan Mock Playwriting Festival. No, I mean, I'm, you know, all kidding aside, I think it's just as tremendous. When I heard about this, I went, yeah, right on. This woman has been working hard, and she's been, you know, she's been toiling away for many, many years. I don't want to say that many years, but, you know, but it's been a couple. And, you know, to have this bounty is amazing. So, A Noble Failure. Wow, that title always gets me. And we talked about this during the stage reading of the production. In many ways, it really is a tragedy, you know. It's a tragedy about the state of public education, the move towards unrealistic benchmarks that have happened in the last decade or so, and standardized testing and privatization as a cure-all, you know, for yes. public education. Since you began this play, has any of this situation changed in Oregon or even nationally?
No. In fact, I think it's gotten worse. We have now the Common Core standards, and those are federal standards now that every state, 48 states have adopted the Common Core standards. And that means that part of the teacher's evaluations now, which means part of their and part of the school, even the stakes are even higher with regard to school closings and teacher evaluations, dependent on the results of the tests.
You're a full-time teacher at Clackamas Community College, and we spoke about the place of teachers as heroes in your life, as when, you know, when you were a student, and also the students that you are now teaching. And I actually got to attend the stage reading of Noble Failure and this production at Third Rail Rep at the same time as your playwriting teacher, Pauline Piotr.
Oh, really? Oh,
and who's still mentoring you in many ways, so very, very proud of you. And I imagine she still gave you feedback on the play.
Yes, she calls me. She goes to every reading. She calls me up. She always has a little thing. She will track a play and will give me notes and talk about what is the resulting, she calls it the resulting action question of the play and the condition of the action. She has a whole kind of, I don't want to say a formula because it's not that formulaic, but a way that she breaks down scripts and looks at scripts that comes from the Bernard Grabenier handbook that we all read or about playwriting that she still uses. And yes, and she takes me to lunch and gives me notes still. And it's wonderful. I adore her.
So without that relationship, though, I mean, often a lot of artists don't have that kind of mentorship for your professional life.
I'm very lucky. I have Pauline, and I also have Gil Dennis, who I adore, who's been a teacher and a mentor for years.
You know, being the teacher yourself, do you feel like that's something you pass on?
I hope so. I hope that I can do that for other students.
I was wondering who you based Rosalind on for A Noble Failure. I mean, she's a teacher. She's, to me, the main character. Now, you may disagree with that, but she's, me too, is the main character. And she's trying to keep a young Russian immigrant in school, and he gets in trouble. And who did you model her after?
It was nobody in particular. It was just a compilation of, you know, of teachers, again, that I've had over the years. I could name you several, both male and female teachers that I've had that have been just people who've loved literature and who have turned me on to great books, and just people who are excited to be in the classroom and just talking about ideas and big ideas and challenging students with big ideas. And the unfortunate thing with the way that the whole testing regime is and learning targets, everything has to be tracked to a learning target. So if you get off track, you don't have time to wander into a great discussion because everything has to be monitored and targeted for the test. And that's frustrating and debilitating. And I think it drives a lot of great teachers, you know, it drives them away. The ability for a really great teacher to come in with creative new ideas, there's no room for that anymore because there's this pressure to get your numbers to keep your school open. And that's why cheating is rampant everywhere. Because schools are closing, jobs are being, and then the privatizers come in. It's like what Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism. It's, oh, the schools are failing, the teachers are terrible, we're going to come in and fix it. And if we make lots of money doing it, good for us. And that's what's happening. And one of the things I struggled with, and this was the character of Barbara that I really, that was the
Well, I
hard,
wanted to talk to you about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, because I think I'll listen to Bill Gates and I'll listen to Michelle Rhee. These are some of the big, you know, well-known, what they call reformers. And I think, do these guys really believe what they're saying? Do they really can? Because if you spend any time in the public school, if you spend any time with teachers or students, you'll realize that there are some teachers out there. Yes, there are some teachers who probably shouldn't be teaching, and there probably should be ways, more expedient ways to deal with those people. That is a problem. However, the way that the narrative has been created about what public schools are is so far removed from what, you know, what really happens. And the great teachers who are dedicated to their students and spend hours and hours preparing and creating dialogue with their students. And so I think, how can these guys not see the good in public education and not understand that public education as a human right rather than a vehicle to mold people in the image of Bill, you know, what Bill Gates thinks should be what he calls a knowledge worker for the 21st century. I mean, I didn't make that up. That's what the kind of words they say. And in my earlier drafts, I had Barbara as kind of a buffoon. And I really didn't get a handle on her till I realized, no, these people are crusaders. They're idealists. Only their idea is short-sighted and I think wrong. It's not. And you can say there are a lot of things about public education. Public education isn't serving the neediest people right now. And that's something that everybody needs to, there needs to be a million conversations all over the country, all over the world, really, about that. Is the private sector the one to solve the problems? I think the answer is a resounding no.
Well, I did, in the stage reading, I felt like the character might have been a little, that Barbara character might have been a little bit more of a stock villain.
Yes.
But, on the other hand, in this production, I think I wanted a little bit more of that villain, you know?
Well, boy, we had so many discussions about that, about who is Barbara and why, you know, that's interesting.
It's
that
a
you
very
say that.
Pivotal and crucial role.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so funny because I've gotten feedback both ways. She doesn't, you don't hit hard enough and, oh, she's too much of a villain. So, you know, she is what she, but that it goes to the complexity of the people who advocate for this stuff.
Well, I know you talked with a lot of educators when you were developing this play and writing it. And I'm wondering, what do you think, or what do they think, or what do you all think is the answer?
First of all, I think the answer right now is to stop testing. I think that's the thing that people have to organize. There are a lot of opt-out movements happening now, is we just have to put a moratorium on standardized testing and then decide. The union issue is a sticky one because a lot of people on both sides of the issue, I don't want to say both sides because it isn't easy as a black and white side, but but just for expediency's sake, I'll say the both sides of the issue say that the unions have posed somewhat of a problem. And I think that if you look at and study what happened in Chicago, the Chicago teacher strike, they really did it right. They went out as a union and had dialogue with parents and said, wait, you know, how is the public school system not serving you? And how is the public school system not serving students with the you know, the neediest students and, you know, the poor students, the minority schools, the developmentally disabled? Because a lot of times, a lot of people, especially with developmentally disabled kids, said, well, at least with No Child Left Behind, people were paying attention to us. And however, a lot of times what happens is these people who buy into the charter school rhetoric end up dropping out of it or getting kicked out of the charter school because the charter school can't serve them or they don't meet the testing regime of the charter school. So they get tossed right back into the public school or they leave. I mean, the attrition rate in charter schools is off the map. It's up to 50% in some states. So we have to say, wait a minute, what's missing here? And have some really honest dialogue with the education community, parents of special needs, and say, how can we do better? Because the money's not going to the teachers, and it's not going to the students. And the state of Oregon, for example, has cut. I just was in a meeting last week. It said we got in, and our CFO of Clack was saying, well, you know, we had this money in the late 90s, and then they cut us back, and we're kind of out. And he goes, well, we're about being funded about where we were 12 years ago. In the meantime, our enrollment has gone up probably, it kind of fluctuates, but between probably 12 years ago, it's up at least 15, 20%. And in education, what people don't need to understand is we take everybody. We don't turn anybody away. And we work with everybody, and teachers and education specialists, we need some help, and we need some support of the state. This is not for somebody to make money.
A noble failure. I think you probably have some amazing after play discussions. Definitely a play of our times and something that needs to be viewed by anybody because we're all involved in education. A Noble Failure by Susan Mock, directed by Philip Cuomo, with an extraordinary cast, especially a shout out with Bruce Burkhartsmeyer, who you're related to, and happens to be your husband. And
I'm not related to him because that would be weird, Dime. He's my husband.
Oh, and Jacqueline Maddox, oh my gosh,
great?
As Rosalind. She's a wonderful, wonderful actress in this.
Yes,
I really admire both of them in this. And it's at Third Rail. It's running through February 3rd at Third Rail Repertory at the Winningstad Theater, located at 1111 Southwest Broadway in Portland. For more info, visit thirdrailrep.org, or you can find out more about all the plays at fertilegroundpdx.org, or go to stageandstudio.org. And we have one festival pass to All of Fertile Ground. Now, it's just one pass, but it's to All of Fertile Ground, including The Lost Boy and A Noble Failure. And these are available via online, so you have to give me your email address if you want to win this pass. So here's the number to call. You can call. It's for the third caller at 503-231-5106, 231-5106. It's an online pass. I just want to make that clear. Sumac, what are you doing after this production, these two productions?
Sleeping.
I think that's a very good plan. I just think it's great that this has happened to you. You know, this is well-deserved, and it certainly should give other playwrights hope that life does exist beyond the staged reading.
I hope so. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your support. You have been so supportive to writers and artists for so many years, and people should know that.
And people can send me money at... If you missed any of this interview, visit stageandstudio.org. We'll also be posting a link at Stage and Studio Facebook page. And before we go, a couple of announcements. Also at Fertile Ground, a reading of Sally Sunbear's romantic musical farce, Hail, will be performed Sunday, 1 p.m. February 3rd at Hip Bone Studio, 1847 East Burnside in Portland. To catch a preview of the show, go to fertilegroundpdx.org and click on the newsroom and watch the Part-Time Playhouse YouTube clip, or catch the January 25th noontime teaser at the Armory. Also, playwright Claire Willett has a workshop opening of a new opera. It's called The Witch of the Iron Wood. It's an operatic tale of Norse mythology with Odin and Loki and all your favorites, you know, and the Kingdom of Asgard. It actually sounds quite lovely. So the workshop is at the chapel at Milepost 5, located at 850 Northeast 81st Avenue in Portland, January 27th, 28th, 30th, and February 1st at 7 p.m. For more info, go to fertilegroundpdx.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of Organicology, the Northwest's largest gathering of the organic food trade. Study the organic industry and shape the future of sustainable eating. February 7th through 9th at the Hilton, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's Organicology, February 7th through 9th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/organic2013.
This Wednesday, January 23rd, KBOO will broadcast live from downtown Portland, where the Illihi Lecture Series kicks off its 2013 lecture series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It, with award-winning author, activist, and food policy expert Raj Patel speaking on who owns our food.
In every food riot that has happened, you've seen a demand for food linked to a demand for political change.
That's 7 this Wednesday, January 23rd. For tickets to the talk, go to ilahi.org or listen live on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM.
Andy Warhol,
I'm Joseph Gallivan, standing in for Ava Lake, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Mariana Trace. Her show, Celestial Clockwork, is on now at Chambers at 916 Gallery in the Pearl and runs until February the 2nd. Welcome, Mariana. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
Likewise, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
The show is called Celestial Clockwork. The title refers to the visionary timekeeping of Herschel McShugal. Mariana Trace is director and steward of the Society for Nebulous Knowledge, an institution that seeks to preserve these supposedly forgotten histories. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Acknowledging, documenting, and preserving these lost archives is our primary mission, as is their presentation for the public view.
And what is the Society for Nebulous Knowledge?
Well, the Society for Nebulous Knowledge is a rare collection. We focus on research that seeks to unburden science of its grave purpose and offer a more open interpretation of the natural world. So toward that end, we collect and preserve previously discarded chronicles and objects, emphasizing the influence of astronomical, metaphysical, and other certain obscure phenomena. You could say we are a collection that embraces a cosmological perspective. And as such, most of the collection is extremely delicate, so it is viewable only by appointment and only for limited periods of time. Actually, the staff at Chambers Gallery has been through extensive training in order to be able to temporarily house and exhibit this portion of the collection.
And the Society focuses on amateur scientists. How do science and the concept of nebulous relate to each other?
Well, I understand the term nebulous in the name of our institution to be related to the nebula we know in space, that is the interstellar clouds of